I am Planta on the Line. This is thecommentary.ca, and today, and this also happens to be the 500th interview, and I'm pleased to have on again Warren Kinsella. He's one of my favorite guests, appearing on here from the beginning nearly 6 years ago. He is a Liberal and served former Prime Minister Jean Chrétien for many years. I don't envision myself ever voting Liberal, but Kinsella is a guy I have great admiration for. He's loyal, and I just admire that quality. He maintains one of the country's best-read political websites at warrenkinsella.com. He is the president and co-founder of the Daisy Consulting Group and the founder of a punk rock band, Shit From Hell. He's a columnist, frequent political commentator, and not infrequent author. His last book was The War Room, a great political read, as was his book from a few years now, Kicking Ass in Canadian Politics, one of my favorite books ever. I'm pleased to welcome back to the Plant Online program Warren Kinsella. Good morning, Mr. Kinsella.
Good morning, Joe.
Thanks for joining us.
My pleasure.
Are people, do you find talking about Helena Gurgis and Raheem Jaffer in the country, or is it just inside baseball sort of stuff?
Oh, no, everybody's talking about it. It's one of those things, you know, there are many issues that come up in politics, whether they're environmental or economic or military or what have you. That require some degree of technical knowledge or expertise or what have you. They're complex. And this one, unfortunately, for Raheem and Helena, is one that has been easy for people to understand. It's got all the elements that people find fascinating, you know, sex and intrigue and wrongdoing and busty hookers, as we've been reminded a number of times. So it's got it all, and it just kept on going. But I have to say, it's gone on longer than I thought it would, and I have to say that it's gone into some corners that are kind of yucky and unpleasant and don't reflect well, at least on the national media.
I'm really pleased that you're the 500th interview. We wanted Raheem Jaffer on, but I guess someone else has him this afternoon.
Right? Yeah, he's busy right now, just about right now, with the House of Commons committee that's probing all of this stuff. And I expect, I used to brief politicians for these affairs at Parliament Hill, and unfortunately the opposition politicians spend too much time making speeches.
Yeah.
And don't use the opportunity to do what you're doing, which is to ask simple questions. And that's a better use of time, and that's a way that a politician can be more effective in a situation like this, but I bet you some of them are just going to make speeches.
Now the Liberals are saying that what happened here is endemic of what's happening in the Harper government. Do you see it that way?
Yeah, I guess what it's endemic of is hypocrisy. You know, Jaffer, you know, got elected in Edmonton many years ago on a tough-on-crime platform. And, you know, here he is some years later charged with drunk driving and possession of cocaine. He's acquitted, or those offenses were dropped. He wasn't acquitted of those offenses. But, it speaks to a hypocrisy. And in the case of the Harper guys, they said they would be all about accountability and openness and they would be tough on crime and all that stuff. And that all of those things seem to be singularly absent from this case. So I think it has an effect of turning people off. And, you know, does it have a long-term effect on the government's fortunes? Maybe not. But that would be one of the points I'm making today, is that these guys say one thing and they do another.
What was your problem with the media over this?
Well, it was last week, a newspaper in Helena Gurgis' riding published a story. I hesitate to even mention it to dignify it, but I have to for the purposes of answering the question, saying that she'd had two miscarriages. And it was later picked up by the Toronto Star, which should know better. And I don't know what the hell that has got to do with anything, how that is in any way relevant other than to the couple who had to deal with that difficulty. And it really reflected badly on the news media. I wrote about it on my website, and to its credit, the newspaper in her riding dropped, or the news website dropped the story. They paid attention to what people were saying in my comments, and I guess they were concerned about whether they'd made the right decision, and they killed the story. But the Star published it, and it was just like, you know, how is this in any way related to public affairs or politics? How is this appropriate? How is this fair to her? You know, she's taking her lumps and then some. But, you know, why do we need to know about something like that? I just really thought it was inappropriate. It was the kind of American political coverage that all of us say all the time we don't want, but increasingly we seem to be getting.
And so the NDP, they tried to call this off, this committee stuff, earlier this week, did they?
Yeah, unusual. They're certainly, you know, leaving aside this the very personal matter between, you know, this couple, there have been other things that are worth us taking a look at. So, for example, it very much appears that Rahim Jaffer was lobbying the parliamentary secretary to the Minister of Natural Resources or Environment, Brian Jean, submitted three projects to him for his consideration along with his business partner, didn't register for any of those things, and are presumably seeking funding, and that would be a lobbying activity as defined in the law. Nor did he register himself as somebody who would be speaking to politicians. That's another requirement. So those are fair things for us to ask him about. And, you know, why didn't you apparently observe these rules? Why didn't you apparently observe these laws? And, you know, there's a lot of material that we can get at here and see, you know, what happened with those contracts that you're seeking. Did you get them? Did somebody else get them? Did somebody related to you get them? Those are all important subjects.
Now, on your website, you're writing about this MP, this conservative MP, Gary Breitkraut.
Yeah.
He ran his mouth off.
Yeah, he's one of these guys. Harper, I got to give him credit. He has known for some time, I believe, that the people who he needs to build his parliamentary majority, that is, more MPs, are often his principal enemy. And this is kind of the old reform rump, reform caucus, the people who came in that wave in 1993. Some of them have left, but some of them are still around. And this guy in particular is you know, he makes Fred Flintstone look like a refined and dignified political presence. He's just, you know, on guns, on gays, on social issues, on women, you name it. I mean, he most notably was the guy who was going to give a speech to some firearm kook group, and they were going to auction off a semi-automatic Beretta handgun, and that caused an outcry, and understandably so. And, you know, he himself is an example of the hypocrisy that I think attaches to a lot of the Harper government. These are the people who used to make fun of the you know, silver-plated MP's pension. Remember that?
Yeah.
Remember how they used to talk about the name Deb Gray and all the rest of them out on the lawn of Parliament Hill with little pigs? They put little pigs all over the lawn. Well, Gary Breitkraut and all the rest of them are all going to get their MP's pension. In the case of this guy from Saskatchewan, he's going to be getting about $110,000 a year. So, you know, I think at the end of the day, that's one of the things when these guys go down that will bring them down. It's that they say one thing and they do another. They become exactly what they said they would never be, which is people who are arrogant and complacent and don't pay much attention to the rules.
And going down, do you see that happening anytime soon?
Yeah, I do. You know, governments defeat themselves, and all kinds of people write about Michael Ignatieff's trouble. And, you know, when you're in opposition, it sucks. Like, the bottom line, it sucks. It, you know, nobody enjoys it. I remember when I was working for Mr. Chrétien, they used to say that we were doomed and we would never be prime minister. I had family members saying that to me. You know, Warren, why'd you go work for this guy? And then I joke with them, of course, well, I guess he did okay.
Yeah, yeah.
Same thing with Harper. In November of 2005, just, you know, a few weeks before the election campaign, you had candidates, conservative candidates, openly calling for his removal. Well, I guess he did okay. So, I mean, in opposition, it's just really hard to get, it's like Rodney Dangerfield, you know, it's hard to get respect. It's hard to get any airtime. And then, you know, the media don't pay any attention to you, and then they say, oh, you're not doing anything attracting, you know, that's newsworthy. And you say, well, then pay attention to me. And it's just tough. You know, you don't have any money to spend. You don't have any announcements to make. You can't do all the stuff that you can do in government. And it's a very tough assignment. But I'm confident that the Harper guys are well on their way to defeating themselves, and that the Liberal Party will form a government sooner or later.
And an election, when would that be? And is it better that it be now or later for Ignatieff?
I was one of the people who favored having it at or around the time of the recession, because my view was that the government was not handling the recession well. And there were a lot of people who thought the same way. You know, we've now got a $60 billion deficit, a structural deficit, and we've got no way to repay it. I would have had the election then, but I lost that debate. There were other liberals who wanted to hold on. And my argument was, well, if you do that, you're going to give Harper time to recover. And he has recovered a little bit. So, you know, my view, just as a rule of thumb, is always go when your opponent is weak. Don't let your opponent get strong. And, you know, maybe we waited a little bit too long to do that.
Well, what's your role with the party now?
I don't do very much. It was doing war room stuff for them in the fall. And it was just, it was tough on my kids, and it was tough on my business, you know, being up and down and waiting, and is it going to happen, and is it not going to happen? So I finally decided to just pack it up and head back to Toronto. So I'm very involved in Dalton McGuinty's re-election effort, because I firmly believe he is going to be re-elected, and I'll be running his war room. I'm doing, paying attention to the municipal politics quite a bit, but I'm not spending much time in Ottawa. I just, you know, I gave it a few months, and it doesn't look like there's going to be an election anytime soon.
The HST, is that a big debate in your province?
Yeah, it is. You know, and everybody's, the various opposition parties are trying to make hay. The Conservative Party here in Ontario had previously been in favor of it and actually pushing the government to enact it. Now that the government's done so, they're against it. So they've got that hypocrisy taint that they're going to have to deal with. And then the NDP, as is in BC, has very aggressively taken the position that they're against the HST. And the problem is, and any of your listeners know in BC or elsewhere, is it's just really hard for the NDP to pull off the argument that they are tax fighters. You know, the NDP can be many things, and some of them are positive, but I don't think anybody regards them as people who are worried about taxes. So this HST, anti-HST mantle, that's something you can see Preston Manning doing, but it's hard to picture, you know, a provincial NDP leader doing it. It just doesn't seem very credible.
And the opposition, is there a great opposition to it in Ontario?
It's been pretty big, and it's just kind of died off. You know, the implementation is taking place on July the 1st, and we'll see what happens. But Tim Hudak is the provincial Conservative leader. Finally, a smart reporter said to him, okay, well, fine, if you know, you're so against it, are you going to get rid of it when you be, if you ever become premier? And he kind of hemmed and hawed, and he finally said, no, I'm not. Well, that takes care of him. And then in the case of the NDP, everybody knows there's not the faintest chance in hell that they're ever going to form a government. So whatever they say is immaterial. So it really comes down to, in my opinion, if the issue is the HST, a guy who is honest about it, McGuinty, or a guy who is being dishonest and pretending he, you know, dislikes it when in fact he's going to keep it, which is Hudak.
Have you been watching these British elections?
I have. You know, the volcanic ash has kind of obscured it, but I guess the big thing, the big development in the British campaign has been the first ever televised debate. A friend of mine, a Conservative friend of mine, Patrick Moutart, was over there for dinner some months ago and gave some tips to the Conservative candidates, and that got leaked to the British media as a big deal. You know, big wheel Conservative activist is over here and helping out. And Patrick really wasn't. He was just giving some tips. And it was interesting to see how the British media treated it, because they really never dealt with televised debates before. And as you and I both know, those can have a huge impact on the way your campaign unfolds and then on and how the outcome is.
And I guess Mr. Clegg, the Liberal Democratic leader, he's
did very well.
Yeah,
yeah. So you know, you can have that's the great thing about televised debates is they're dramatic. You know, and it's one of the reasons why politics is fun and why guys like you and me are attracted to it. Is it's unpredictable. And you can go into a televised debate with a healthy lead and you're playing it safe and you're the boy or girl in the bubble, and then something bad happens in a debate, which is usually when people are tuning into the campaign, and that could be the end. You know, you could lose.
And the debate that they had, the first one last week, I mean, that was just fun to watch. I mean, the way that it was crafted and the sort.
Yeah, no, and then really, and what was interesting for me is the British, British public saying, we like this and we find this interesting, and you get some old, you know, fuddy-duddies who say they don't like this and it sensationalizes it and all that kind of stuff. But, I mean, it is a great way for us to test our political leaders and see how they interact and see what their skills are. It's hard for them to fake it. There's no advisors there to hide behind. There's no talking points or, you know, spin or any of that kind of stuff. It's just them kind of almost naked in front of the TV cameras. And it's a great, great way to test their abilities.
I watch Glenn Beck a lot, so I'm wondering.
You shouldn't do that.
No, I shouldn't. No, I'm wondering how Obama's working out for you.
Well, I love him. I am unabashedly in love with Barack Obama. Yeah. If you saw my office here in Toronto where I'm speaking to you from, I've got more Obama paraphernalia than probably any other Canadian. So he is, I think, doing an amazing job. Anybody who can survive the most brutal recession the United States has ever gone through and then push through something like health care reform and completely emasculate the Republican Party in the way that he did. You know, he gave them an opportunity to compromise, and they blew him off. And so not only has he survived the recession politically, he's going to have health care. So at this point, you know, in the midterms, is he going to lose some seats in Congress and Senate? You know, for sure, but every president does. The question is whether he loses so many that he loses the balance of power. But at the end of the day, he's got health care reform, and any legislative attempts by the Republicans to overturn it are going to be stopped now by a presidential veto. So, I mean, he changed history, and, you know, for a guy who was supposedly politically weak because of the recession, that's pretty impressive.
I just got an eye touch about over Christmas because I went on vacation, and I took it with me, and I just love it. And now you have an iPad, right?
Yeah, I lined up with a bunch of nerds and geeks in Buffalo, New York, a couple weeks ago. Mainly just so I could write about it, and I could put stuff on my website and kind of make fun of it. And so I was skeptical. I was a latecomer to the iPod. I now have an iPod as well as a BlackBerry. This device is amazing. And, you know, when I was sitting in line, I was talking to people and kind of interviewing them. And one young guy beside me was an engineering student. And I said, you know, what are you doing here, Lee? You don't need this. You know, you're a smart guy. And he said, well, I'm visually impaired. And he said, all of these other devices that are out there, I can't use them. But this I'm going to be able to use because it's going to be sufficiently large that I can read it. And then I conducted various experiments. I handed it to my 8-year-old, and I didn't tell him anything. I just handed it to him and watched him, and he immediately intuitively figured out how to do a number of things on it with great facility. And then my mom on the weekend, 75 years old, she loves to play Scrabble. I said, here, try this, because I downloaded the Scrabble application, which is just beautiful. Production values are amazing. And she's in love with it. So she's on her way to Philadelphia, as you and I speak, and she's going to the Apple store to get herself an iPad so she can play Scrabble. So it's an amazing device, and I think it's completely different than the iPhone or the iPod and your Mac, and it really has the potential for changing a lot of the way we do things.
Yeah, you had a video of it, and it looked cool.
It is cool.
Yeah.
It's really, you know, if you're interested in visual, I got it so I can read books because I find it's an easier way to read books. I've got a union client I was talking to about the iPad last week, and I said, you know, so these guys on the work floor, in the workplace, you know, have to go around and check machinery and do checkoffs and, you know, testify to the machines being safe and all that stuff. I said, now you don't need a clipboard anymore. You got this thing. You can go through it and dot, 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 and then send an email to you, you know, the boss is saying, you know, what you've observed. Like, it is an amazing device. You're going to see it in schools. You know, all the obvious stuff that you've heard about, you know, it's clearer for watching a movie than going to see a movie and videos and things like that. But it's it really is something else. I think it's something that's going to change the way a lot of people work.
Are you working on another book?
I am indeed. It's a book about the history of spin. So basically, I'm taking the position that spin doctors haven't just existed in this era. They've existed going back to St. Paul, and they're people who didn't have a lot of money or resources but knew how to change minds and, you know, move hearts and minds, just using the power of rhetoric and persuasion and advocacy. And people like that have always fascinated me. So that's what my next book's about.
Yeah, that just sounds like fun. You're a pretty good writer, Kinsella. So.
Thank you.
Yeah.
So are you.
Thanks very much. I appreciate this, Warren, and we'll talk again.
My pleasure, Joe.
Thanks.
Congratulations on the 500th show.
Thanks very much.
Take care.
Thanks.
Bye-bye.
The website is warrenkinsella.com. Warren Kinsella on the line from Toronto in Vancouver. I'm Joseph Planta.